But it was an unbeatable side for whatever reason, you know.
But how did you do it, Phil? 120 hours a week.
Yeah.
A 200-mile commute.
Yeah.
Did you come down for training sessions?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I used to get off at 5 o'clock. So it took me 2 hours. I was fortunate. I'd just started earning, and I bought myself a TR7. And so I could do it in 2 hours. I'd get here at 7 o'clock for training.
So you've always driven quite quickly.
And as you well know, I've recently incurred the wrath of the local magistrates. Now I'm retired. I'm glad to say I'm able to slow up a little bit. But my life was rugby and work, and working 120 hours. I would train at lunchtime. We had a weights room, and I'd have the physiotherapy. And when I look back on it, I was very fortunate to be doing medicine, either in medical school for the years that I was training. I used to train every lunchtime, weight training, believe it or not, but I did. I had to train every lunchtime. And I trained every evening. So even when I was on call, and when I talk about those 120 hours, yes, you were in charge running the hospital, but you could normally find half an hour, 45 minutes. Mm-hmm. And certainly I remember regularly training up and down the Gloucester, you know, the tower block of Gloucester.
Mm-hmm.
And I would be up and down, there's 11 flights of stairs there, and I'd go up and down there 3 times. And I'd do that on three lots over a course of 30 minutes, carrying my bleep. And if there happened to be a cardiac arrest, I would turn up and I would be sweating like hell, and they'd say, "Oh, I thought you were fit." The fact that I'd gone up and down the stairs 3 times. All I wanted to do was play rugby and do medicine. And the rewards were there. And when the rewards were there, you didn't mind doing it. And that's when we come on to the following year.
No, let's not do that yet.
Oh, okay.
Because I haven't finished with 81, 82.
Okay.
Because I want to tell you, we talked about the semi-final at Coventry.
Yeah.
You scored the try-in to get us into the final. But actually, the round before that was against Exeter, which was a much more comfortable win. But the highlight from that was hat-trick of tries by Pete Pritchard.
All in the first half.
Teague must have been feeling generous that day, I guess. I suspect, is that right? Gosh.
Yeah.
I knew it had happened.
Your hat-trick for Gloucester was that day.
Yes. Well, as you know, my mother was my biggest fan, and sitting in front of us is all the cut-ins. And so I'm sure, yes. That's very nice of you to remind me of that. So shame we couldn't save one of them for the final, wasn't
true,
it?
Yes. That was a very handsome 34-3 win against Exeter.
Exeter, yes. Yeah. Well, that's we play them at the end of the season now, don't we?
Yes, that would be good, wouldn't it?
Yeah, nice little hat-trick for one of our boys. And just to throw this in, of course, Charlie Sharples, his dad, went to Westminster Medical School and played in the centre with me.
Oh, really?
So Charlie Sharples' dad and I played together at Westminster Medical School in the centre. Yes. And fascinating thing is, as I said, as you well know, when my rugby career ended, I went totally away for 20-odd years into the horses, and I never looked at another game. And the very first game I came back and watched here, it was part of the players' reunion, and I thought, Christ, that lad on the wing has got something about him. I didn't know who he was, and I thought, and I'm maybe not being as modest, I thought, God, you know, you sort of play like I used to play a little bit, you know, or aspired to play, let's put it that way. And they said, oh, yes, yeah, a lad called Charlie Sharples. And it was then, the following season, I'd arranged to meet his dad. Didn't realise it was dad, and of course, two and two came together, and he said, oh, yeah, that's my lad. Amazing.
Lovely. Then at the end of that season, well, literally, you left Twickenham to go to Heathrow, only couldn't get on the aircraft, if I remember correctly, because there weren't enough seats left for you.
Well, that was the way the team was. There was enough seats for the majority of the team,
yeah.
But Mike Nichols, Dick Smith, and the team immediately said, if you can't put all of us on, we're not going, because we are a team. And I don't know whether you knew, but there was a little financial inducement out there. A little bit of financial compensation. And I think some of the boys found their way back towards the London area that night. I'm not sure quite how much we can go into that, but we staggered onto the plane the next day.
Yeah. 24 hours late, which probably didn't help with the first game in South Africa.
Well, if anything is to blame why things went apart, it was that tour. And as you know, it was probably the most disastrous tour that anyone could have experienced.
Yeah.
And as you say, first of all, the plane was delayed 24 hours, and quite a few of the lads had to go back into London to... And it was a strange thing, although we hadn't lost the game, we felt we'd not won it.
Yeah.
You know, yes, years down the line we can say we were joint winners, but, you know, that's not the same as winning it outright.
No.
So
it felt more like not winning it rather than not losing it.
It was a relief that we hadn't lost,
yeah.
Exactly. And as you had to suffer in the stands, at least we were trying to put it right in on the pitch, but... It just felt like nothing was going to happen that day. And then, of course, we arrived
in
second.
Well, we had one or two back on the way back.
I'm sure I'm sure you did. But it was a dampener, wasn't it? It wasn't right,
yeah.
You know. And
well, it was partly just it seemed inconsequential to me.
Wasn't right. Why didn't it happen? And in fact, you partly felt it was a dream. It was a nightmare. Don't worry, we'll wake up tomorrow and we'll play the final.
Yeah.
And of course, we woke up.
Well,
I'd
be the first to pour scorn on the American view of you have to have a winner, but actually, it felt like you needed to have a winner.
There wasn't something right, was there? And we came away with. Fortunate draw, and by the time we sort of came to, we were in South Africa getting off the plane. Fantastic reception, photographers, you know, we were made felt very, very welcome into this land because obviously, as English champions, we were welcomed. But the welcome stopped there. We found ourselves in a hotel with other teams. You know, we didn't have our own hotel. You were siphoned from one place to another. We didn't really probably realise the gravity of the situation from an apartheid point of view. And I think, as you said, within another 24 hours, we were out on the pitch, playing at 6,000 feet, and took a right...
And suffering.
A right shoeing. Yes, it was. And I distinctly remember... mentally you felt you were going to do something, but physically it just didn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
and of course now with modern science and whatever, we know what we were basically jet lagged, we were hungover, mentally we weren't in the right place following the defeat, and physically you were suddenly trying to fire on 95% oxygen, you know. And when they kicked the ball, it seemed to go the length of the pitch, and when we kicked the ball, it didn't. and it was a shocking tour. We played, as you're probably going to remind me, two other games and got beaten in both of those. There was a little incident with the law, and we all felt that we were set up with that, I must admit.
Right.
It was felt that it was a bit of a set-up job.
Mm.
And we found ourselves having to report to the police station every day. I can distinctly remember meeting 301, and Dick Smith's room was room 301, and it became, you know, seemed like every every hour there was an emergency meeting in room 301, not to discuss rugby, but to discuss how we were going to cope. And as you know, some of the boys did not return from that trip. Remanded in custody or
not immediately.
No, but there was certainly the tour. I think we came back early because we were due to go down to Cape Town, and that part of the trip was cancelled. And we certainly, I think we were relieved to get away from it.
Yeah, must have been. What impression did you get of apartheid on that trip?
Fascinating, isn't it? I've been fortunate, as I said, since consequently to have travelled the world with my riding career. I've represented Great Britain from a riding perspective and been all around the world, including Madagascar and other India, Sri Lanka and places. It was shocking in the extent to see the no blacks or whites only and whatever. We were very uncomfortable with it, and as much as we tried to integrate as we would have thought normal, it put everyone in an uncomfortable situation, in so much that the blacks that we were trying to incorporate into our hospitality were uncomfortable at being there because they knew that they shouldn't. The most shocking part, in fact, was we were given a few days rest and recuperation in Zimbabwe, and we went to Zimbabwe and we were put up in this magnificent hotel, and we were given a fair dosh of money, courtesy of the hotel, to spend, you know, on their roulette tables or on the golf and whatever. And right next to the golf course, there were people living in mud huts. And as I say, I've been fortunate enough, consequently, to travel to foreign places where there's been poverty. But these kids were hungry. These people were struggling to live. As I said, I've been to Madagascar and South Africa and India and Sri Lanka and Russia and, you know, places, you know, where you'd think there is poverty, but generally kids have been well fed and they've been begging, but, you know, it's part of the culture. But
it was the contrast of privilege and poverty.
Privilege and poverty, yeah. And we were kept apart, you know, and I just had, and a lot of the boys, we had this burning desire to actually go in amongst them, and we did. We were giving them the money that we were given, because it was ludicrous. The money that we had would pay for these people to live for a year, and we were just giving it to throw away. So again, we weren't mentally prepared for that sort of thing, and I think it really did shock a lot of us.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
So,
do you think that had an effect on the
following
the whole team in the next year?
Well, what was our first game the following year? You'll be able to tell me. I got a feeling it was
there.
Stroud, and we lost.
Right.
I know that. I think I'm correct, because a patient of mine came in one day, and he said, "Oh, can you remember this game?" And he showed me the program, and it was Cullimore, Roger Cullimore, who sponsors Stroud, and he said, "Oh, here we are, the time Stroud beat Gloucester," and it was, and we had virtually that list of those names that we had our proper team out, and we lost at Stroud. No disrespect to Stroud listeners, but it wasn't as expected. And you'll be able to tell me it went downhill from then on.
Yes. It wasn't a good season, the following season.
Well, I got a feeling I read somewhere, and you'd probably be able to tell it, this is one of the worst seasons that Gloucester had ever...
Because very rarely it was a losing season, in that
we
played 54, won 24 and lost 25.
We lost more games than we won.
Yeah, so lost 25 after only three the previous season.
And I hate to say it, I wasn't by the end of that season, I was not enjoying my rugby. And for me to say that, it was is frightening. I wasn't enjoying my rugby.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're going to come to why I packed up.
But you played in 32 games that season,
right?
So you played
so
in
played
almost
more,
as many as you had.
Yeah.
Previously.
Well, the interesting one, this
you
got.
But you only scored 3 tries, as opposed
exactly
to the last the year before.
Incredible, isn't it?
Yeah.
Absolutely incredible. I didn't realise I played that many games.